So nice to have you back, Cleary, on this podcast.
Hey, it's Friday.
Yeah, again.
We survived a week so far.
Yeah, exactly. And let's get started, Larry, with what's going on between Hezbollah and Israel. The pager bombing, that walkie-talkies, talk about other electric devices. How did you find this attack? And how do you categorize these type of attacks?
Well, let's start by categorizing it. It's an act of terrorism. It's one thing to, you know, that they're claiming that it was targeted only at Hezbollah leaders and fighters. But that's not true. That's not what happened. By sending out booby-trapped items indiscriminately. And when I say indiscriminately, it doesn't matter who they're supposed to be delivered to. You've got to have full confidence that you're putting the bomb in the hands of somebody who's would be considered, if you will, a combatant. They got two dead children. They're not combatants. If Hezbollah, let's just reverse this. If Hezbollah did this to the Israelis, that they managed to infiltrate and send a bunch of communication devices to the Israeli military, but it was blowing up in the hands of Israeli children. Does anybody think for a minute that there would not be howls of outrage about this as a terrorist attack? Absolutely there would be. And frankly, it would be justified. So that's exactly what we've got here. We've got a terrorist attack. Israel's a terrorist state. People don't like to hear that, but when you're killing women and children like they are, and it's not just in this attack in Lebanon, when you go back to what they've been doing in Gaza, that to the civilian population there, it's horrific. And the world really stands by, and we pluck our tongues and say, oh, that's too bad, but nobody except the Houthis really has done anything to try to stop it.
Yeah. And in your opinion, why they have decided to do this? Why have they decided to do this? Because right now, if they had some sort of access to these devices, somebody, they want to spy on them. And why have they decided to do that?
Well, the story that appeared in the papers the day after this happened, and it was citing Israeli sources, stated that they had intended to use this as sort of a, let's call it a surprise attack, a Pearl Harbor event, at the start of an invasion into Lebanon. So when they were going to move their military forces into southern Lebanon, they were going to detonate these and decimate the communications and leadership of the Hezbollah military command. Okay, I could see that as, it's a very creative, albeit deadly, approach, but somehow they got word that some lower level Hezbollah operatives are starting to examine and realize they may have a problem. So instead of calling off the operation, they accelerated and said, let's do it. Now, when you do this kind of thing, this was an intelligence operation from the outset. The problem with it is once you detonate, you've now, in a mass detonation like this, coordinated with multiples dead and wounded, you immediately expose your tactic. So now the Hezbollah will be recognized that these kinds of devices could be compromised, and they'll set up a protocol to inspect them, so you could never get back in that door. I know several years ago, right after this goes back to 1979, after the Iranian Revolution, I was told, I didn't have you know, I didn't see a classified document on this, but I was told by a friend who is knowledgeable that when the Iranians came into power, they were looking to set up a new telephone system. And they contracted with a company. It turned out it was a CIA front company. And CIA never divulged that. You know, who knows? Maybe it's still in place today. But that when you've got that sort of intelligence operation, you keep it quiet. You don't go out and compromise it. And like I said, I think the what was done back then, you know, no longer exists, which is wild. You know, I'm just using it as an example. So here in this case, the Israelis took, you know, they obviously had got a penetration into Hezbollah because they knew what they were buying. They knew where they were buying it, and they were able to come up with a way to insert themselves into that supply chain. Now it's gone. So that to me signals an act of desperation, because when you compromise something that is, you know, that sensitive, and to accomplish what? Oh, we killed 40 people. Yeah, we killed some kids. And, you know, they've maimed maybe another 3,000-4,000 people, or wounded them anyway. It hasn't destroyed Hezbollah. It's just made Hezbollah more enraged about seeking revenge. And then, I guess, just this morning over in Beirut, the Israelis launched another targeted missile attack in Beirut, Lebanon. Understand this. They are launching attacks against a sovereign nation. They're committing an act of war in order to try to kill a senior Hezbollah leader. And apparently they did kill someone who was in the chain of command. But it doesn't stop the war. It doesn't eliminate Hezbollah's desire to free the land of Palestine from Israeli occupation, in their view. That's how they view it. So this war is going to escalate. I think that's the one thing that's guaranteed.
It seems that Netanyahu is so much in favor of having a big conflict with Hezbollah, because in my opinion, he's willing to sacrifice the whole Israel because of his position in Israel right now. And do you think it's all about, we are talking about this, but in your opinion, that's the reason?
Yeah, apparently he has no regard for the future of Israel. Israel cannot kill its way to peace. That's not going to happen. The Western image of Hezbollah and Hamas is really it's an exaggerated image of ruthless terrorists who are out, you know, killing women, children, and, you know, taking human life without any kind of afterthought. It'd make the world a lot simpler if that was the case, but it's not. And in fact, the actions of both Israel and the United States, particularly the United States in places like Syria, were the ones causing the death of women and children, which then fuels outrage and desires for revenge against us, which then sends us, you know, we get these cycles, the spiral of violence. And, you know, Netanyahu is, you know, he's facing serious charges of corruption. And in order to save himself, he's keeping Israel on a knife's edge. But, you know, it's really, in terms of him as a personality, he's not that popular. But the policies he is pursuing are widely popular in Israel. And so it's almost, we shouldn't make this all about Netanyahu. because even if Netanyahu's gone tomorrow, that's not going to change Israel's policy. They're not going to suddenly say, oh, yeah, let's sit down and negotiate with the Palestinians about having a two-state solution.
But the risk of having a bigger conflict would reduce, it seems, that because we have Gallant is totally against him in going and fighting Hezbollah. And that's why we have this type of conflict within the government, within the administration.
Well, Gallant reversed himself. You know, initially he was opposing, now he's on board. So there are very few what I'll call credible voices in Israel. And what do I mean by credible voices? I mean someone who is widely respected and popular, that the population says, yeah, you know, I'm going to listen to him or to her. It is, you've got to, yes, there are some very brave Israelis and very brave Jews that are standing up and speaking out against this, but they're not seen as being part of the mainstream. The mainstream of Israel right now is they are possessed, let's call it possessed of a demonic spirit of murder. They will kill anyone that gets in their way. With, you know, killing children, great, because the Palestinians aren't real human beings. I mean, this is the ultimate irony of what we're facing, that the state of Israel, which was created out of the ashes of the Holocaust, and coming out of a situation in which Jews were treated as subhumans, as Untermensch by the Germans, and subjected to, you know, death camps that were set up in Poland, and then incarcerated in concentration work camps in Germany. You'd think that coming out of that, that you'd say, you know, we didn't like it when it's done to us, and we certainly can never do this to anyone else. Yet turn around and they're doing the very same thing to Palestinians that was done to them. And you know, if you try to raise that
point, Germans,
yeah, but if you try to raise that point with the Israelis, you're immediately, you know, you're considered an anti-Semite. And you know, the irony is they're doing this to Semitic brothers. Because if the Bible's to be believed, then, you know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob had a brother, Esau, and, you know, all of these folks there are descendants of Isaac through either Jacob and Esau. They're cousins. I said, if you're going to believe the Bible, but there is no, you know, like so often, sometimes the bitterest fights are those between family members.
Right now, Netanyahu is insisting to send these people to their homes, to the northern part. He's moving a lot of weapons, tanks to the northern part of Israel. How do you find this policy? Is he trying to get Hezbollah killing these people that maybe he can finally get to a bigger conflict?
Oh, no. Well, his goal to return the people to the north is the justification for the military operation for this invasion of southern Lebanon that's going to happen. That's the only way they can return people to the north. They have got to destroy Hezbollah military presence south of the Litani River. And so that the only way to do that is going to have to put ground forces in. So that's what Gallant was opposing, because he's hearing from the military, you know, we can't do that. We're not going to be able to accomplish that mission, because they recognize that Hezbollah is not what Hezbollah was in, 18 years ago. So in 2006, or I guess 22 years ago, No, it is 18. I'm having trouble with math this morning. It is 18. Israel invaded southern Lebanon, again, trying to push out Hezbollah. Hezbollah fought them to a standstill. Now, the difference today is Hezbollah, in this last 18 years, they've built up very sophisticated defensive positions, entrenched, underground, interconnected, impervious to being hit with fixed bombs from fixed-wing aircraft or missiles. They have more trained fighters who have not just, you know, sat around and attacked unarmed people, but they've been involved with combat in Syria against radical Sunni Islamists that, frankly, are funded by and trained by the West, by people like CIA, MI6. And they've got more sophisticated weaponry now. Rockets, missiles, drones, anti-tank guided missiles. They have artillery, and they have air defense systems. So Israel is going up against a more powerful force than it faced in 2006. And Israel is, itself is not, you know, hasn't made dramatic strides. If anything, right now, the Israeli army is a little worn out. They've been fighting for 11 months in Gaza. Well, I don't want to call it fighting. I mean, because they're largely going up against unarmed civilians. But they've been fighting a guerrilla war. And like any guerrilla war, the insurgents, in this case, the Hamas fighters, are hiding out in tunnels, hiding out in the rubble, and they're able to move around and ambush and pick off an Israeli here or there. That takes a toll. It is it requires them to be alert 24/7. And, you know, like you've learned with having kids, when you are sleep deprived, having to stay up with minimal sleep, it wears you out. And so you just get physically exhausted. And that's part of what I think Gallant was objecting to, that, you know, we can't put the military into this situation right now. They won't be able to sustain it.
Is this type of attack, this terrorist attack, capable of making some sort of insatisfaction, unrest within the society to turn against Hezbollah, saying that they're not capable of doing anything?
I can see it increasing pressure for Hezbollah to act more decisively against Israel. I think some said they've been holding back, which I believe they have. If you notice, Hezbollah has not been trying to attack civilian installations across Israel. They've been going after military outposts. They've been going after kibbutzim that have really more of a military function than just, you know, peaceful civilians living an idyllic life. So they've been somewhat cautious up to this point with the reckless attacks by Israel. That could change. And you could see Hezbollah say, okay, we're going to take the gloves off. So that these kinds of attacks, I think, may actually incentivize the leadership to take stronger action. And that's one of the, you know, one of the dangers of, let's call it, a decapitation strategies, that you try to say, oh, we're going to kill the upper leadership. Well, a lot of times the people that will step in to replace them could be more radical, more extreme, less cautious, and potentially more deadly. And if that's what you want, then fine, go that route. But, the parallel to this is the West obsession with trying to get rid of Vladimir Putin in Russia. Again, to get rid of Putin, what comes next? Medvedev is, by judging by his rhetoric, is no Vladimir Putin. The man could be called a hothead. And, you know, he wouldn't hesitate to use a nuke, perhaps. So, I mean, that, you know, it's just the unfortunate thing about what's going on with Hezbollah and Israel right now is this: it's spiraling out of control. I don't think there's any one country or nation right now that could step in to stop it.
Shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine, Ursula von der Leyen is in Kiev, and Zelensky is talking about we have to put an end to this conflict, it seems, by the end of this year.
Yeah.
How do you find it right now, Derry?
Well, they're losing across the board. Number one, promised funding and supplies from the West is slowing up and stopping. Yeah, I just saw that Borrell from the EU, you know, they promised 1 million rounds of, you know, ammunition, or was it artillery shells? Then he said, yeah, we promised it, but then we found out we can't produce it. That old character from way back before your time, the Popeye cartoons, they had this,
I know that
character, Wimpy. Hey, I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. Well, you know, Ukraine's gone out and they've been promised to be paid. They're not getting paid. When you look at what's taking place on the battlefield in the Donbas, Russia is moving at an accelerating pace across a broad front. And so it's not just confined to one city. You know, for the first year or two, we had the Battle of Mariupol. It's just all this fighting in this one location. Then we had the battle in Bakhmut, which strung out over 6-7 months. And then Avdiivka, you know, again, it was always in one location. You know, there's skirmishes and everything, but just the concentration. What's happening now is concentrations at, you know, 6-7 different locations. And Ukraine doesn't have the trained manpower, nor the munitions, nor the vehicles, nor combat air to stop the Russians. So the Russians are continuing to move forward, and they're being very strategic about it. They're not just rushing, you know, doing human wave attacks against Pokrovsk, for example. They're enveloping it, and they're going to get it and surround it and put it in what's called a cauldron, a boiling pot, that they will entrap soldiers. And as they're enveloping it, they're cutting off the lines of communication. The reason Pokrovsk was so central is that it was where all these road and railroad networks came together. It was like a neural center. But from that center, then it would go out. Well, it can't go east much anymore. And its north and south access has also been restricted, if not even completely cut off as we talk. So it's just a matter of time before that's defeated. Up in Kursk, you know, they're being decimated. The Russians are hunting them down. People say, oh, you're just repeating Putin talking points. No, I'm actually repeating what Vladimir Zelensky told CNN the other day. He admitted that for every one shell they fire, the Russians are firing 12 back. Hello? If I'm firing 12 at you, that increases the chance that you're going to suffer injury or death, which is exactly what's happening. And Zelensky also acknowledged that, you know, 80% of Ukraine's power grid is gone. It's destroyed. Maybe it could be eventually repaired, but in no time in the near future. So this is with the onset of winter, it will make the cities unlivable without electricity. And so you're going to see probably another massive outflow of refugees from Ukraine. And over the last 2.5 years, they've already lost half their population. You know, the pre-January 2022, roughly 42 million Ukrainians. Now the number, last number I saw, is around 19 million, maybe 20. But, you know, that's more than half.
Gary, what has happened in the meeting between Starmer and Biden? And are European pushing for the continuation of this conflict?
Yeah, they're pushing, just but the reason they're pushing is that the Brits can't do anything on their own. I mean, hell, these guys can't even, they barely can get an aircraft carrier out of port to sea. And as soon as it gets out to sea, it breaks down and they have to bring it back. I mean, England is a malevolent joke. They have gone from being one of the preeminent, the colonial power in the world. I mean, the reality was going into World War I, they dominated the world. They controlled India. They controlled Hong Kong. They controlled South Africa. They controlled parts all around the world and were such a, they were a mighty political force. They had significant military assets. Their navy was the best in the world at the time, or at least in the top three. But now look at them. You know, they barely got, they got total strength in their army, 70,000. And of that, you'd be lucky to get 30,000 that could be combat ready. They've eviscerated their manufacturing capability. They used to have a significant steel industry, no longer. I mean, Sheffield Steel was sort of one of the, was a brand name that was out of England. England's not there anymore. So yet they've got this obsession with, they're going to destroy Russia. It's a combination of envy and jealousy that they're obsessed with a vision of Russia as this authoritarian place where, hell, the ones getting locked up now are, if you're a British citizen praying outside an abortion clinic, you get locked up. They're locking people up for postings on social media. You know, so you don't want to sit and hear any lecture from any Brit about so-called oppression in Russia. You know, they need to look in their own mirror and fix their own damn house.
Do you... Right now, in your opinion, who's in charge of the policy in Ukraine? And is he still Antony Blinken or somebody, is the Pentagon is deciding about these things?
I don't have a clue. I mean, that's that is a question I think every major country in the world is wondering. Who's running Washington? It's not Joe Biden. You know, and so is it Jake Sullivan? Is it Blinken? Is it Lloyd Austin? Yeah, do they sit around and, you know, have arguments and vote and see who's got the majority? You know, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. It appears that in this last round, what happened last week this time. If you go back a week ago Wednesday, what we had was leaks coming out of Washington and London that they were going to give the green light to Ukraine to use, you know, missiles to strike deep into Russia. So that it looked like it was good to go. I mean, we had Congressman Michael McCaul, who's a Republican, but he was saying, oh, yeah, he's heard that that's what's going to happen. Okay. And he'd been pressing for this in congressional hearings anyway. Then on Thursday, you had Vladimir Putin come out and make his statement that, hey, these missile attacks would be considered an act of war. Now, have you had Gilbert Doctorow on your show?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I heard him yesterday on Judge Napolitano. And the man, frankly, is just so wrong, it's possible to begin. he was making this line of argument that, oh, this wasn't a big signal by Putin. This was, he's just playing to a political audience. It was meaningless. Bullshit. It wasn't just Putin that said it. Then after Putin said it, you had Ambassador Nebenzia at the United Nations say it in a more stark sense. You had Foreign Minister Lavrov say it. You had Deputy Foreign Minister Rybkov say it. And you had the Russian ambassador to the United States say it. Whenever you get the top echelon of the foreign ministry of Russia coming out and hammering on a point that Putin said, you better damn well take it seriously. And apparently, someone at the Pentagon at least picked up on it, because when Keir Starmer and David Lammy, his foreign secretary, when they showed up in Washington and had that meeting with Biden, you know, Biden was the cranky old man. You know, he's yelling at the reporters. He's, you know, like that guy yelling, "Hey, get off my lawn!" You know, Biden was not happy that they were being forced to back down. But apparently, the reports are, and I don't have any way to confirm it, that Lloyd Austin weighed in and said, "No, you're not going to do this." Now, the other reason I bring up Doctorow, when he told Napolitano that the United States got something new with this JASSM missile that can shoot 1,500 kilometers into, you know, 1,500 miles into Russia. No, look it up at Wikipedia. The maximum range of the most sophisticated there are at least three variants of the JSAM. It is 500 miles. You know, big difference. Now, a JSAM, if they had agreed to use the most advanced JSAM, which I do not believe the United States was going to do, that could have reached Moscow. But the regular JSAM that is more widely available right now, it can go out to about 300 miles. So if you look at the distance from Kursk up to Moscow, that's over 400 miles. So it's just to illustrate that this decision to put in place, to green light strikes deeper into Russia, none of the West weapon systems really are capable of hitting St. Petersburg, Russia, other than drones. And the Russians didn't draw a red line in the sand on drones. They didn't say, "Hey, you hit us with drones, we're going to take that as an act of war." But the targeting that comes with the use of the missiles, because the missiles also, there's in some cases, could be equipped with a nuclear warhead. That's the concern.
Yeah, because it seems that during this conflict, Putin did everything in order to reduce the casualties on the Russian part.
Absolutely, yeah.
If they do that, if they send these long-range missiles to Ukraine, hitting deep into the Russian territory, that would make some sort of huge problems within the society, because we know that how sensitive Putin is toward this type of attacks. And they may kill a lot of people with these attacks.
We do have the history of war, not just in any one place. So the notion that you inflict enough damage on the population will rise up and overthrow the government. That's the theory. Let's look at the American Civil War, the Battle of Vicksburg. The Union soldiers had that city surrounded and were shellacking it. Civilians didn't rise up and overthrow the Confederate soldiers entrenched there. They supported them. It built support. Battle of Britain, when Germany was bombing the Brits. The Brits didn't crack. And conversely, with the Brits and the Americans bombing German cities, Hamburg, Dresden, the Germans didn't rise up and overthrow Hitler. So this this excuse for killing civilians, and is it doesn't really translate into a military victory. That's why what, you know, the Russians have been very careful. Anyone that's going to objectively look at this over the last 2.5 years of not causing widespread civilian casualties. They've tried to limit it. They've gone after military targets. They've gone after factories, plants that are involved with production of military equipment or ammunition. They've gone after power plants. That, yes, that indirectly affects civilians, but it's a way that you create discomfort that civilians maybe will leave. That's a far cry from blowing them into you know, 1,000 pieces. So this strategy by Ukraine to say, and it's not just Ukraine. I've heard a lot of Western pundits. General Ben Hodges was on the other day with Danny Davis talking about this. They got themselves convinced. Oh, the Russian people, they're just looking for an excuse to get rid of Vladimir Putin. And again, and it comes back, we touched on this earlier. What in the hell is wrong with these people in the West that believe if they get rid of Putin, man, and our magic, oh, solution, all problems solved. For the love of God, Putin is a moderate. You know, he's been a voice of restraint, counseling, caution. Instead, well, because one of the biggest criticisms of him in Russia is that he's too soft. And it'd be one thing if we in the West were as powerful as we'd like to imagine that we are, but we're not. We can't even produce 155 millimeter shells at any rate, or Patriot missiles, or ATACMS missiles, or JSAM missiles, or go down the list, or M1 Abrams tanks. You know, we don't have the industrial capability to do that right now. Could we rebuild it? Sure. That takes some time, and it would take a complete refocus of this society, and it would end up creating an economic crisis, because right now we're already in debt beyond the wealth of our country that is measured by GDP, and launching on this kind of military buildup would further put us into debt.
Yeah. One of the points in the Zelensky's victory plan is to get an invitation from Joe Biden to be part of NATO. Do you think that Joe Biden would do that for them?
No, but Ukraine will never be part of NATO. Ukraine will never be part of the EU. And there's a question whether there will even be a Ukraine in another year.
It seems, because the way that they're thinking of it right now, they're thinking being part of NATO would facilitate their entry to the European Union. The way that it seems, that, because Yermak was talking about this, we have to drag NATO into the conflict as much as possible.
Oh, you mean like how it worked out for Turkey? Right? Oh, yeah, let's get Turkey into NATO and it would pave the way for the EU. Yeah, good luck with that 30 years later. Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. This is all just mindless political posturing. Ukraine is a dying country right now. It's dying. It has lost more than 50% of its population. They're in other countries, and they're probably not coming back. On top of that, you've had probably in excess of 1 million casualties. And you know, some have suggested a million dead that are between the ages of 20 and 40. Well, those are dead men that aren't going to be fathering children. And if you're not fathering children, you're not replenishing society, and society is going to grow old and die. That's what Ukraine is dying, and the West needs to recognize it. There really is, at this point, it doesn't appear any way to bring him back to life. They're a terminal patient. You know, they're in hospice. Let's put it that way.
Do you find it as a good sign that the way that Joe Biden is reacting to Europeans not to send his long-range missile as a sign that from now on we're not going to see any sort of escalation on the part of NATO?
No, because everything, this decision to try to not ramp up at this time and provoke the Russians, that calculus could change after the election. So if right now the Democrats don't want to do anything that will seem to potentially jeopardize their ability to try to get Kamala Harris elected. But once the election's passed, if it looks like Harris is going to be president, then all bets are off. I mean, good God, the idea of that woman, you know, as mentally demented as Joe Biden is, she's even worse. You know, she can't claim dementia as the problem of her, complete lack of judgment with respect to foreign policy and international affairs.
Larry, Stoltenberg recently was talking about the GDP and how they have to increase their defense budget considering their GDP. And here is the clip he was talking about it.
The alliance has gone up substantially. All NATO allies now invest at least 2% of GDP in defense or have plans to get there soon. And for the first time, total defense spending across Europe and Canada is above the 2% target. So the good news is that we have delivered on the pledge we made 10 years ago. But the bad news is that this is not longer enough. That is why NATO allies have agreed to spend at least 2% of GDP on defense. And that is why we have agreed on robust defense plans with specific capability targets that outline what each ally needs to provide in terms of weapons, forces, and readiness for our security. To meet these agreed targets, allies will have to spend significantly more than 2% of GDP on defense in the years to come.
Yeah. And do you consider it, are they getting prepared for conflict with Russia, or at the same time they're thinking of China as well?
Well, define they. Okay, so if you're going to say NATO leadership like Stoltenberg, are they getting ready to try to fight Russia? Yeah, in their fantasy world, they are. If you say, are the people in Germany, in Poland, in Romania, in Hungary, in the Czech Republic, in the Slovak Republic, in France, and are they all agitating? Yeah, let's go attack Russia. No, they're not. And in fact, that's one of the problems that's emerged, that you've got this widening rift between some political leadership and what the public is saying and doing. In Germany in particular, the German economy is in sort of a free fall. It's collapsing from within. They're not growing, they're receding. The automobile industry is in real trouble. Good God, the land of Audi, Volkswagen, BMW, Porsche, you know, these are, you know, tremendous brand names of German engineering that they always used to brag about. It's becoming a joke now. So, you saw just recently Poland, they keep demanding an apology from Ukraine for the murder of over 100,000 Poles during the Wolin massacre in 1943 and during World War II. And the Ukrainians are saying, "Ah, screw off. You know, we're glad we killed them. They deserved it." You know, you've got neo-Nazis that are key elements, key portions of the Ukrainian government. And you can't keep covering that up and pretending that that's not real. So the you know, Poland's not exactly of a mood right now to go all out for Ukraine and to build, you know, let's fight Russia mentality. That when Vovan and Lexus, the two pranks, the Russian pranksters, got Radoslav Sikorsky on the phone the other day and got him to, and you know, he spilled some real dirt as far as like, yeah, we're not really keen on fighting the Russians. Nope, nope, nope. That's not going to happen. You know, give the man credit. You know, neocon that he is, he was expressing some sanity. And then just within the last three or four days, I guess the Ukrainians are just viciously attacking Sikorsky. Oh, that way to go, guys. You know, they have no diplomatic sense at all. And the reason the Ukrainians are acting that way is they are like a drowning man who will drag anyone under with him, trying to save himself. And they're past the point of salvation. That's what's taking place.
Yeah. Just to wrap up this session, Larry, recently we had an interview, Hillary Clinton had an interview with MSNBC in which she was talking about and Russian interference in 2016 and right now how they're trying to do this. And let me play it for you.
As Mueller indicted a lot of Russians who were engaged in direct election interference and boosting Trump back in 2016. But I also think there are Americans who are engaged in this kind of propaganda. And whether they should be civilly or even in some cases criminally charged is something that would be a better deterrence because.
Yeah, a better deterrence.
Yeah, the only one that should be criminally charged is that lady. And look, I say that as someone, I've met her. I briefed her on the situations in Iraq and Afghanistan back in summer of 2007. And I used to think that she was that she had some intelligence about her, but she's flat out lying. I mean, for God's sake, it is proven that the entire Russiagate narrative was created by her campaign. She created that. The Russians weren't doing it, and the only country in the world that has consistently meddled and interfered and altered the course of leadership in other countries is the United States. No other country in the world, Russia and China combined, have not been involved with this much subversive activity. Just ask the people of Syria. Just ask the people of Libya, Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Guatemala, Dominican Republic, Haiti. I mean, let's just keep going down the list. Argentina, Laos, Uruguay, Brazil. Okay? So I don't want to hear any American lecturing anybody from any other country about meddling in our elections. We need to lead to keep our own damn hands to ourselves. And we can't. We're incapable of that. So all we do is we continue to meddle, continue to interfere in the political affairs of other countries, and then get outraged when somebody calls us on it. I mean, watching Hillary say that is just absolutely appalling.
It's, can we consider it as an act of self-destruction? Because the way that the government was using Russian analysts during Nixon, Vladimir Syme, and he was working with Nixon. And right now they're talking about he's a Russian agent and he's helping Russians. Yeah. And why do they need to make these allegations? Because at the end of the day, nobody would benefit from this in the United States. They have to use these people to understand the behavior of Russian government, to how to deal with them.
No, you're wrong. We need that enemy. We need Russia as an enemy. We need China as an enemy. Otherwise, we can't justify an $850 billion defense budget. So we can no longer claim that terrorism is this huge threat that requires $850 billion, because it's really not that big of a threat at all. You know, we can trot it out from time to time. Oh, the Iranian terrorists are trying to assassinate Trump. But the real issue is how are we going to spend more money on General Dynamics and Raytheon and Lockheed Martin and Boeing and, you know, go down the list. It is out of control. And this the added treating modern day Russia, because what I listened to this General Hodges the other day when he was talking with Danny Davis, referred to the Russians as animals. They're animals. And the narrative is that, oh, Russia's been invading. It's trying to reestablish the Soviet Empire. Yeah, do you remember all those Soviet states in South America? Oh, no, neither do I. All the Soviet outposts in Central America and in Africa. No. Remember all the military bases that the Soviets and the Chinese had scattered around the world? No, the only country that's got 700 plus military bases around the world is us, the United States. So, I mean, stop with the projection. It's really thickening. And it is, you know, I've gotten fed up with it, because when I hear it, when it's used here at home, you get the Americans going, fuck yeah, yeah, USA, USA, and we start chanting and get all excited. And what we're doing, though, is promoting death and destruction in the world. We're not bringing about peace. We're doing just the opposite. And, you know, personally, I've had enough of the killing.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today.
Yeah, I say, and on that cheery note, off to the weekend. All right.
Bye-bye.
I'll chat with you on Monday. Have a good weekend.
I'll see you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.